a little extra, we'll say an extra loop in it. So I'm doing basically the same kind of motion, but put an extra little chunk in that one. So, but most people make nicer looking ones than that. Okay, I admire other people's succeed. They're hard to make, and especially when you see my C's were better when I first started taking Greek and was taking more time with them, but now that I've written, you know, gotten used to writing it faster and so forth, then they kind of degenerate a little bit. It's like my English handwriting. Yeah, right. Okay, so then all you're concerned about, get a good squiggle in there and keep going, you know. But the main thing is that even if you're not making them, you know, in the most beautiful form, if you've got a clear distinction between the two, that's the thing I'm watching for most. Is first that I can recognize what letter it is, and then make sure that I can distinguish it between the zeta and the xi. Okay. One more point here on the on chapter one is the transliteration, and we're kind of moving away from that transliteration. We've already had a quiz on it. Let me just see if I'm going to give you any quizzes. Yeah, there'll be a little bit. There'll be a little bit on this quiz coming up. Not a whole lot, but you will have to be familiar with the transliterations for this quiz as well. And so just study those transliterations on page 4. I guess the main things that one needs to note are the fact that several letters are transliterated by two letters in English, the theta, the phi, chi, and psi are all coming out as two letters in English. Notice that the upsilon is transliterated either by a U or by a Y. It's transliterated by a U if it's a part of a diphthong. It's transliterated by a Y if it's by itself. Those are the main things. Watch for your eta and epsilon. Make sure you get a bar on the E for the eta. And the same with the omicron and omega. Bar on the omega, O for omega. Okay, then notice this note one, these notes on the top of page 5. Again, these are things that are easy to forget. The gamma is rendered by an N when it immediately precedes kappa, xi, chi, or another gamma. So there's four letters. Now this rule we'll be looking at some more later on when we get to making changes in stems and this type of thing, adding, when we start verb forms over, there's some interesting things that take place. So we'll be watching these kinds of things. There's some other changes that are somewhat similar to this kind of an idea as well. Anyway, in transliteration, you will consistently transliterate a gamma that comes before one of these four letters by an N. And then if you ever see something in English transliteration, cranking it back to Greek, you'll know that an N before one of these certain four letters is going to be a gamma. So gamma gamma is NG, gamma kappa is NK, gamma xi is NX, and gamma chi is NCH. Okay, then the Greek theta, phi, chi, and psi are each represented by two English letters. I mentioned that. And the Greek upsilon is transliterated, rendered by U in the combinations alpha, upsilon, etc., the diphthongs, in other words. Yes?
You haven't mentioned omega.
I think the reason there is that it just only occurs once. The only place you've got it is Moussa's. And I think in the transliteration of that, you would do the same. You just he's going to consider that a diphthong. There might be some differences of opinion on it. What, page 8, do you have that? Okay. He doesn't put a transliteration on this. I'm just curious to see. It's considered a diphthong, so presumably you would transliterate that as a U there, too. Just didn't add it, because there's only one word that's in the whole Bible, that the whole New Testament, that uses that.
That would look funny if you made
it. Yes, really. Okay, so just assume that the omega upsilon is in that category too. Just that there's only one word in the group. Okay, any other questions on lesson one? Just want to make sure that we tie up all the loose ends here. Okay, lesson two is pronunciation, and a quick review here. Remember that we are using a system of pronunciation that's somewhat artificial. It's kind of a cross between accurate and artificial. In other words, wherever we can use the pronunciation that we feel from the data that we have available about the original pronunciation of Koine, we're pronouncing it that way. But in some cases, we're purposely diverging from that in order to get a different sound. And that's for the benefit of the students. Since nobody's speaking Koine Greek anymore anyway, then there's no real reason to try to imitate a pronunciation that's current, because there's nobody that's speaking Koine. And if you try to go to modern Greek pronunciations, you'll end up with a lot of confusion, because there's so many similar sounds and so forth, and that's really not our purpose. So we've come up with a certain standard type of pronunciation with a few variations. Textbooks in English and in Biblical Greek will vary on a few points, notably the epsilon, the iota diphthong, and the omicron versus omega sound. Those are the two major areas that I've noticed a difference. Some textbooks will pronounce the epsilon and iota as a, and like we do, and others will pronounce it as I. And either way you go, you get some confusion with another letter. If you take it the way we're taking it, you can confuse it with eta. If you take it the way other books take it, you can confuse it with alpha iota. So we just have to make a choice. And then the omicron, and we've decided here, at least as far as I'm concerned for this class, to pronounce that the omicron is an O sound, and the omega also is a longer O sound. Okay, then. But as I mentioned, don't be dogmatic about your pronunciation system. We've had to make some decisions. Other books have made other decisions. And don't judge one another on this basis, since it's artificial anyway. All right. The vowels are given first here, and pronunciation for the vowels. Any questions on any of those? Okay, we have more vowels now in Greek than we have in English. In English, we've only got five. In Greek, we've got seven, because we've got, instead of just, they're all the basic type, we've got the A, E, I, O, U type sounds, but in your E category, you've got a short and a long, the epsilon and the eta, and in the O category, you've got a short and a long, the omicron and the omega. And then we have a set of diphthongs on top of that. So, bottom of the page, we see the diphthongs. And basically, the way to remember the diphthongs, I think it's easiest, is to remember that they'll either end in an iota or an upsilon. So all the diphthongs are either iota or upsilon. And in the iota category, you've got alpha iota, epsilon iota, omicron iota, and upsilon iota. So there's four in the iota category. And then in the upsilon category, you've got alpha upsilon, epsilon upsilon, omicron upsilon, eta upsilon, and omega upsilon. So basically, let's see, what's missing there? You don't have any upsilon, and you don't have any iota upsilon. So it's only two of the letters that don't begin one of those diphthongs. Okay, then the pronunciations of those diphthongs are given here. Alpha iota is I, epsilon iota is A, omicron iota is oi, upsilon iota is ui. Like in Queen, alpha upsilon is ow, is an owl. That's quite a common one. Epsilon upsilon is one that's a little bit more difficult to pronounce, perhaps, but it's ew type of sound. Usually, when you're saying it fast, though, it just gets almost a ew type of sound. I'm not going to worry about that. Omicron upsilon is oo. It's a long oo, like in soup. Eta upsilon is ew. That doesn't occur too often. And omega upsilon is ou, and mouses is only the only word that uses that particular diphthong. Okay, improper diphthongs. This is where we, of course, use this iota subscript symbol. And the main things to note here are the fact, number one, that there's no difference in pronunciation, the iota subscript as opposed to the regular letter. And it occurs only in three letters, the alpha, the eta, and the omega. And so no difference in pronunciation. And then when you're writing one of these words in all capitals, instead of putting an iota underneath it when it's a capital, the iota comes up on a line and is written as an adscript, or written after the letter. So that's one of the features to note on those. Question? What was that? On the quiz? I can't remember. I think I've got a couple questions on transliteration. I've definitely got some on transliteration, so be sure and review the transliteration for the quiz. Chris?
In the proper diphthong, it's an Yoda Ascript or an Upsilon Ascript? Is that what it becomes?
No, there's no, there isn't any Upsilon Ascript.
What's the diphthong setting with the Upsilon?
Oh. Now those diphthongs, you see, there aren't any of those that have a subscript. It's only iota subscript that ever occurs.
So they only make a difference only because of that subscript.
Right. Yeah. See, there's only three letters that have an iota subscript type of setup, and those don't necessarily even correspond to. If you look over here on your diphthong list, you've got alpha iota, epsilon iota, omicron iota, and upsilon iota, but you don't have an eta iota and you don't have an omega iota. Those aren't real diphthongs. That's maybe part of the reason these are called improper. The alpha iota we have, but over here when we're talking about improper diphthongs, there's only three letters, alpha, eta, and omega, that have the iota subscript. And that helps you also because you won't get them confused except for the alpha iota with anything else because you don't see that combination anyplace else. And these are written underneath, except when the first letter is a capital, and then you get the adscript. All the rest of the time, it's underneath. And the vast majority of times that we'll be seeing them, they'll be subscripts. So there shouldn't be any confusion there. Yes, Dan?
Now, if you have to do something like was off capital,
mm-hmm.
It would be off capital except the iota.
No, that iota would be capitalized also. That adscript would be capitalized. Yeah. So, for example, I think I gave an example like this. Suppose we have, this is what the word looks like to start with. I had to really look to find a word that would work for this. But suppose we've got ade, and this is an alpha with the iota subscript. Now, suppose we're going to write this word in as the first word in our sentence. Then we're going to capitalize the alpha, but we're going to use an adscript for this iota. And so the word will look like that, and we've got our smooth breathing. And then, no, I guess this one's a rough reading. I'm sorry, ade. Okay, like that. Now, suppose that I'm going to write this in an uncial manuscript where it's all in capitals. Then, it's going to look like this.
How do you know that second one is in ade?
Context. That's all. Yeah, see, because now when you're... But this is not too bad because you're kind of recognizing, although you might even be confused here. But it's just knowing the word. Knowing if you see it the first time, there isn't any way to really know. It's just a matter of knowing the vocabulary, knowing the word that this thing started out the other way. So that's your problem. Now in uncials, you don't have reading marks or anything else. So that's the way that word would look in the uncial manuscripts.
When you have a rough reading.
What was that? Well, not in an uncial. If we were going to write it, yeah, you would. But in an uncial manuscript, you don't have any reading marks or anything. So. On a transliteration test, if I tell you to transliterate all caps, yeah, go ahead. Definitely put the reading mark.
Doesn't the manuscript come in at a later date, like about 900?
Mm-hmm. Roughly about that time. Yeah, I think maybe closer to 600 and so forth, but.
All they had was caps.
Right, exactly. And so later on they began to change this. And they may have even pronounced these things at first, you know, and then streamlined it later. And so the kind of form that we've got later on is using subscripts. Because you see, the indications are that that these things were, they're called improper diphthongs now. It's probably a streamlining of the language, that's what I would guess. That they had but none of this is going to change the meaning of the word really. As far as, you know, this is the way the word appears, in the unsealed manuscripts, and that's what we have to start with, that's what we're working from. And the language streamlined a little bit later on, so we're writing it down a little bit differently later on, but this hasn't changed the meaning of the word. Yes?
In a transliteration,
let's say there's
a word where we have an I in transliteration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if that's a proper?
Well, yeah. If it depends on the direction that I give it to you. Something like this, actually in the transliteration, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference.
Excuse me, if you're asking us to take English back into Greek.
Okay, if I give you something in English, see the transliterated forms for these improper diphthongs are an A with a bar I, E with a bar I, and an O with a bar I. So you've got that little bar on the top to indicate the difference. And so I'm not going to try to play a lot of little tricks with you on this kind of thing. I just basically if I give you, in other words, I don't think I would give you something like this and ask you to try to decide whether this is an improper diphthong or not. The only way I would do that is if it was a vocabulary word we had already studied and you learned and memorized and knew, then I might do something like that. But I wouldn't do something like that, you know, without giving you some kind of warning or something, or telling you it's an improper diphthong or something. Because there isn't any way you'd know unless you knew the vocabulary word going that direction. But if I gave it to you in an English transliteration, and I gave you, you know, A with a bar, I, B, B with a bar, then I would expect you to be able to give that back to me, you see, and make sure that you get an iota subscript on it. Because the only way you're going to see A with a bar, I, is with an iota subscript. And the same with O with a bar, I, and E with a bar, I. There is a, see, O with a bar would normally be omega, but O with a bar I, there's no such thing as an omega iota combination. So you know that this has to be omega with iota subscript. And there's no such thing as an, if I had to give you E with a bar I, there's no such thing as an eta iota combination. So it has to be eta with iota subscript. You just have to know that there's no such thing as eta iota and no such thing as omega iota. That's the reason why they can get by with the symbolism that could be confusing otherwise, because that other combination never exists. Okay.
Does that particular one have an H on the front of it if you translated the top?
Oh, yes, this one would, yes. Thank you. Yeah, because of the rough reading, right. So this is the way I would give you in transliteration form, and then you get that rough reading representing the H. Thanks. If I didn't have an H on it, then it would be a smooth reading that you put on it. Okay. Any other questions on this? That's probably the toughest part of it, this improper diphthong type thing. But you will be seeing a lot of improper diphthongs later on, especially when we get to the dative case. So far we've just dealt with nominative and accusative. The dative case forms typically have the iota subscripts in them. And later on when we get to verbs, the subjunctive verb forms typically have an improper diphthong. Yes?
If you transliterated the middle one with capital, would it just be a capital H in English and then the rest of it?
Right. Yeah, like this one? Right. Right. Exactly. A with the bar, I, D, E with the bar. Mm-hmm. This is the source of some confusion, too, because we get this, typically you get mixed up with an eta down, a capital eta in Greek. So you just have to kind of watch yourself on those. Okay, anyone else?
Eta,
the capitalized,
the rough reading on
eta. Okay, so are you saying that if we had a Greek word that began with a capital eta and had a rough reading? In English, this is going to come out capital H, E with a bar, small e with a bar. So that's what can be confusing. Because this capital H corresponds to this, and the E with a bar corresponds to this. So different things are getting capitalized because they don't have a capital form of a reading mark. Okay. I think we had one or something like that. Herodes, isn't that the one we had in the exercise that did that? Okay. I know. That's why I like to get out of these chapters on transliteration and just write in Greek from then on. We never have to worry about it again. Yes, Dan?
No, if you're doing all capital.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you've got all capitals, let me just check here. I don't know if you ever addressed that issue or not. See, on a diphthong, your breathing mark comes over the second letter of the diphthong. Yeah, it's going to have to come out before. Where did you put it? Page 11? Okay. Yeah, before, if it is a capital, that's over a vowel. Second vowel of the diphthong. Okay, I don't know if he deals with it when it's all capitals. Yeah, did I give you one with a diphthong? Right, yeah, I think he's asking about, not an improper diphthong, but he's asking about a regular old average ordinary run-of-the-mill diphthong. That is beginning a word, and you've got a breathing mark, but see, now the diphthong, you're going to have two capital letters represent those, because you're writing all in capital. There's no problem if you're just writing it, if you're using a diphthong. See, Suppose we've got Omicron Upsilon beginning a word like Uranus or something, like that. Okay, and I'm using this as a capital beginning. Well, there's no problem. The breathing mark's going to go over the second letter of the diphthong. But what if I'm going to put this all in uppercase letters, you see? Then what am I going to do? Well, that would be a Y. What am I going to do there? Well, I think that you're probably just going to have to stick it out here in the front because there's no room to stick it in the middle. I don't think he even addresses that case.
Here, I can't find a specific address of that particular situation. But I don't know what else you could do but put it out in the front.
I don't think so.
See, if it was all cast, it wouldn't have the breathing mark on it.
What
was
that?
If it was all cast, it wouldn't have the breathing mark on it.
Well, in English, the English transliteration wouldn't, but in Greek you would expect to find some. But see, the thing is, in real Greek, when they wrote in all capitals in Greek in the unsealed, they didn't have breathing marks on them. So that solves the problem as far as what you would really ever see. The question is, do we need to really be worried about this at all? And my guess is probably not. That's why he doesn't even address it. So let's put it this way: I'm going to give you something on the test where you'll need to do that. Just because the book doesn't cover it either. But this situation you would have to be familiar with.
Okay. Let's see. I was looking for an example of this too. Now that should be no problem. It'll just go over the second letter of the diphthong. And there's plenty of room there if you're only capitalizing the first letter. Okay. Anyone else? The accents here. We've just got some basic rules for accent in this chapter, and on the test, you needn't worry about on the words getting the accent in the right place because we haven't put a lot of emphasis on that yet. But you should review these basic distinctions in the accents, know what the basic kinds of accents are, and in other words, you wouldn't need to know anything more than what you see right here. And we're not going to lay any emphasis on accents for a while, but just know that there's three kinds of accents: the acute, the grave, and the circumflex, and they're all indicating stress. And about the only other thing you need to know about them is that when you combine an accent with a breathing mark, the breathing mark comes first, then the accent, unless it's a circumflex, in which case it goes over the top. So you don't really need to know anything more about the accents than the fact that the stress is on the syllable with the accent, regardless of which kind of those three it is, and then that. When the accent's on the first syllable like that, where the breathing mark and the accent would be on the same syllable, the breathing mark first, then the accent, regardless of whether it's an acute or a grave. And if it's a circumflex, it just goes right over the top of the breathing mark. That's about it for now. We'll get into some more accent rules later on. Okay? Yes?
Which of the circumflexes is used most often in grave?
Which one of the circumflexes is used most often? Boy, that's real hard to say. In other words, you've got one that's kind of like this and another one like this. I think it just depends on the type font. You know, the UBS uses this type here. And does anybody at Kingdom Interlinear with you? I've forgotten what, I think they use the kind of this more of this type, but I can't remember. Maybe it's the same. You see? It's just the smooth. Is this one over here?
Yeah.
Okay. So both of them are using this type, whereas the textbook here uses more of those curly types. The textbook's using more of one like this. So I always make them just like this. It's easier for me, but I don't know. I've never taken a poll of all the books to see. Go through the Greek books and find out. But I really don't pay attention to it that much. You know, you can tell a circumflex when you see it. So okay. So I don't care which one you use in your you know, whichever fits your style the best, that's fine. Won't be any confusion. All right. Any questions about the stresses other than that? Just knowing that there's three types of stress. You don't need to know when one is used as opposed to another. We'll cover rules on that a little bit later on. Okay, then punctuation. Greek punctuation marks are like those of English, except that, remember, these punctuation marks have been added later on. They are not necessarily something that was indicative of the original Greek. Remember, the unsealed manuscripts were all run together, and there wasn't any punctuation marks. So these were things that were added in. And you will notice that in UBS, they'll give footnotes as to variations in punctuation
Those aren't based on different manuscripts. Those are based on different editors and the way that they, the way they broke the sentence down and divided up the punctuation. So that is something you should take note of and be aware of, that when you're doing a grammatical analysis of a particular passage, you needn't be bound to the punctuation that you see in UBS or Westcott and Hort or any of those texts. Most of the time they're going to be fairly accurate, but consider the possibility in some cases of alternate punctuation, and be aware that that may be a possibility.
Is it mostly unambiguous because of the
right endings? Yeah, the inflectional endings and the kind of grammatical system that Greek has is what is removing a lot of those ambiguities. But in some cases you still end up with some ambiguities. Remember that in John 1 that we're reading, that where they took hogegonon out and stuck it in the front of verse 4. That's a case where there's a difference of opinion between the King James translators and between the editors of the UBS text. And they've made their division markers in a different place. So there's a few cases like that where there might be some potential differences of opinion. In hardly any case, though, will that difference of punctuation make a huge difference in the meaning of the sentence or the meaning of the statement. It may make a slight difference in emphasis, is about the most that you'll see. Sometimes what you'll see that in Greek is that there's an ambiguity as to whether a given phrase is a statement or a question. We'll get to some of that later on. Some places there's no ambiguity. There's a clear question system. But in some cases, it's only intonation that makes a difference, and it's kind of a matter of opinion whether the thing's a question or a statement. And sometimes there's meaning both ways that's kind of interesting. So maybe we'll try to get a chance when we're translating to look at some of those. Okay, so the punctuation, basically like English, except that what we call a semicolon is used for the question mark in Greek. So in UBS and Kingdom Interlinear, Westcott and Hort text, that most of the texts you're going to be using that aren't uncial type print, you're going to see this what looks like a semicolon for the question mark, and then a period that is used a period. It looks like a period, but it's above the line. That's going to be used for both the colon and the semicolon. Other than that, it's like English. The comma's like the English comma. The period's like the English period, indicating the same things. Okay. Any other questions on those features? All right. Chapter 3 is linguistic structure. We're not going to go into a lot of detail in this, just to summarize the basic points that were made. He talks about defining things, and his whole approach is to look at these things on a more general basis than the normal definitions that we've learned for English grammar. The definitions we've learned for English grammar are so, let's say, pretty much adequate for dealing with English, but when you're starting to generalize to other languages, then they become inadequate. And so he tries to break it down a little bit more basically. And he defines language as a system of habits of a very specialized sort. He further on goes down and talks about the three systems in a language: the phonological system, which is a system of sounds that we're not all that concerned with because we're interested primarily in meaning. Then the second was the grammatical system, and that's divided into the morphological and the syntactical, or syntactic system. Morphological dealing with forms, the syntax dealing with how you arrange the forms to get meaning. And then there's another system that specifically focuses on the meanings, and that's the semantic system. And that is dealing with the meanings that are associated with the forms. Okay, so then he goes to break this down further, and doesn't say too much about the phonological system, but the grammatical system there, we begin to look at that in more detail and see, first of all, under the category of the morphological system, he deals with this concept called a morpheme, which is the smallest unit of a language that has meaning, smallest part. And then usually what we're dealing with is parts of words. Sometimes it might be a whole word, but it's a word or parts of words that transmit meaning. And so he gives a number of examples of that, like the ly morpheme in English indicating an adverb and so forth. Does anybody have any questions on this concept of a morpheme? Okay. Then we have, the concept of a morpheme is valuable in English, but you'll see it's more valuable in Greek. As we begin to break down our nouns and our declensions and our conjugations of Greek verbs, we'll begin to notice that there are certain consistent patterns with the suffixes. Most of the suffixes are not just a single morpheme, but they're more than one morpheme. And we're already starting to get a little hint of that with our declension endings. Notice the other day I was mentioning how that when we look at the first and the second declension endings, for example, there's a tendency for the second declension type. An O type of sound, and then the first declension to have either an A or an E type of sound, but the last letter is often the same, like the accusative singular is the nu in both the first and second declension, and then you get the omicron iota or the alpha iota for the nominative plural, and you get a sigma in the end for the accusative plural. The reason for that is that there apparently are two morphemes there. One morpheme is indicating the declension, the other morpheme is indicating the case. And if we begin to look at it this way, it makes it easier to begin to see how this stuff fits together, and it's not just a bunch of random endings that you're having to memorize. And it can cut down your memory load when you begin to see the parallels between the various forms. So we'll do more of that as we get further into the book and get more endings and so forth to look at. We'll begin to see some of these patterns emerge, and that's the reason for this discussion of morphemes. So if you've got that concept, you can begin to see how things can be put together to transmit meaning. Okay, then, the morphological system has its basic unit as a morpheme. Then the syntactical system, he just makes a few statements to the effect that that is a matter of arranging these morphemes into words, and then the words into constructions, and the constructions into sentences. So we've got bigger units of structure and syntax based on these little morphemes. And so he defines a construction as a group of words that are interrelated by some special grammatical device, and they function together as one unit. The gloomy dean was a good example of that, can function as a unit. Even though you've got an article, an adjective, and a noun, they're all tied together by grammatical devices, and they function together. Then a sentence he defines, rather than saying it's a complete thought, he rather defines it more in terms of a group of, something that the speakers of the language understand by intonation patterns and so forth as being complete. Rather than saying a complete thought, because some thoughts are more complete than other thoughts. And he's really zeroing in on an intonation pattern here. That's telling us when the sentence is finished and when the person who's speaking the sentence is considering that thought complete. So that's a little bit more basic definition. Question?
Yeah, in the
grammatical system, he's dealing with both. The intonation pattern is primarily associated with the phonological system, the sound. However, it's represented in the written form by punctuation marks. And so really what he's saying, if we want to restrict ourselves only to the written form, it's the period that's marking a sentence. That's what he's saying essentially. And then when we read that, that translates into a certain phonological intonation pattern. That's what we're picking up when we see that period. We have an intonation pattern, and that's how that's being transmitted. Because when you're speaking, you don't say so-and-so and so-and-so, period. And so unless you know, sometimes people do that just to be emphatic, but the point is you're not speaking those punctuation marks other than intonation. Intonation or pauses or this type of thing is what's transmitting that information. Okay, the semantic system is the system that is associated with the meanings of these forms, and he lists three criteria, three basic features of these systems. Part A here, the relationship between the forms of a language and the meanings which they express is conventional. Conventional simply means that the meanings that are associated with the forms are what the people who speak that language accept as the meanings for those forms. In other words, there's not any intrinsic similarity between the sound of a word and its meaning. There are some words in almost every language that they call onomatopoeia or whatever, where they get the sound of
the word sounds kind of like the thing. Murmur, huh? Clap. Plop, yeah, right. That's a good example. In Greek, petuo, you know, first bit. In Hebrew, there's sounds like this. And, yeah. So there are some that the sound of the word is similar to the sound, the meaning of it. But in general, that's not what you're going to see. That the only reason that we think, you know, you use the example of a pig here, the only reason that we've got a negative association with the word pig is because pigs are dirty, you know. It's not because, you know, if we picked a different word for it, we'd have a negative association with that sound. Okay? Then, the second point is that the relationship between the forms of the language and the meanings which they express is seldom one-to-one. In other words, within one language, a given word may have more than one meaning. And that meaning will be determined by the context. And that is generally the case. It's very much true in English as well. One word will have many different meanings depending on the context. The word light, L-I-G-H-T, for example. You can talk about turning on the light. You can talk about lighting something as a verb. You can talk about something being heavy versus light. You can talk about color, dark versus light. You get lots of different contrasts and different senses of meaning. But the context is what's determining what the meaning is. And he used the example of bank here, and both as a noun and as a verb. So these words will seldom have a one-to-one relationship between meaning and form. They'll use the same form for several different meanings. And then, of course, on the reverse, you may get the same meaning with several different forms. That's what synonyms are. You'll have several different words that all mean basically the same thing. So there isn't a one-to-one relationship between meanings and forms. And I don't know of any language that I'm familiar with where that's the case, although there may be some. I don't know. Then, third point is that because of those other facts, the relationship between the forms of a language and the meanings which they express is rarely the same in any two languages. In other words, you compare two different languages, you're not going to find one word in this language being the exact equivalent of another word in this language, simply because of the fact that within both of those languages, the forms and the meanings may have, may not be one-to-one. If that's the case within the language, it's certainly not going to be the case that that one word in one language is going to have the exact same range of meanings as another word in another language. And therefore, we should not expect, when we're translating from Greek to English, to be able to always find one English word that's equivalent to that Greek word. Sometimes we can do better or worse depending on, you know, how close these things line up, but we need to be real careful about this. This is why there are such translations as Amplified and others, to try to use as many words as necessary to capture the idea of the Greek. One thing that I hope you will all find by the time you're done with the second year, if you stick it out that long, and I hope you all will, that is that after a while, when you're constantly exposed to Greek and you start reading in the New Testament, you will begin to start thinking in Greek rather than in English. And instead of translating consciously as you're reading along, consciously translating that Greek phrase into an English equivalent, you're getting the meaning directly out of the Greek without having to translate in your mind. Now, some of you may not be able to relate to the possibility of that yet, but take it by faith, as it were. You see, what's happening when you get to that level is that you are not subject to the limitations imposed by translating because of the fact that there's not a one-to-one equivalent. Rather, you're picking up both lexical and structural meaning from the statements themselves. You're understanding the meanings that the Greek is transmitting. And then if you were pressed to translate it into English, sometimes you'll find yourself saying, no, I don't know how I would say that in English. You know, and you might find yourself giving a number of different words or several phrases or explaining a whole picture rather than trying to find one equivalent word. This will happen with prepositional phrases oftentimes. If somebody, you know, John 1:1 is a good example. NRK, ein ho logos, kein logos, ein proston theon. That phrase, proston theon, they translate, of course, as with God in the King James, because they're looking at a Trinitarian, you know, three persons, you know, together, you know, with one another, and so forth. But that's not the picture at all the Greek is conveying. But it's not, you know, you could say toward God, that might be a little bit more accurate, but that still isn't painting the picture real clearly to you. But after you've seen the word pros over and over again and used it over and over again in the Greek and seen it in many different situations, you look at that and you're getting a meaning from that that you have to sometimes sit down and say, now how am I going to explain this to the English, you know, speaking person who's not seeing this picture? And so that's a good place to be in. Now, it's a little frustrating in some respects because sometimes it's hard to transmit the exact shades of meaning to the English-speaking person. However, it gives you a much greater sense of confidence in dealing with your own biblical exegesis, so you know that you're not just dependent upon somebody else's idea of what it means. You're not like the person that's going through the lexicon and deciding, well, this guy says this, and or he says it means this and this and this, and you pick out the one you like the best. You know, you have a more solid basis for picking out the best English equivalent because you're seeing the picture that's involved in the word, not just the details. So we'll be doing something with Greek prepositions in the second year, whereby you get a chance to do some research on your own and study these things out and begin to ascertain what the word picture is. And I think that really will boost your confidence in being able to understand what Greek is all about. Okay, so the systems are seldom the same in any two languages, the systems of forms and meanings. And he gives examples both ways here. He gives examples where the English uses the word left over and over again in all these cases, and the Greek has a different word in all these different cases. And another case where the Greek word logos is translated in the English by a number of different words. Okay, so that means indicating that it's not one-to-one, or excuse me, that they're not the same in two languages. Okay, do we have any comments or observations about that? Any questions about the basic concepts involved there? Okay, then in chapter 4, we have the grammatical analysis chapter, and now he's starting to zero in on certain grammatical devices that are used to transmit meaning. And he starts out by making a distinction between lexical meanings of words and structural meaning. And he makes it clear that in any language, the meaning that we get from a certain utterance is based upon two things. Number one, the lexical meanings of the individual words. In other words, the meanings of that those words transmit. And then secondly, and equally important, the structure in which those words are arranged. We're getting meaning from the arrangement of the words as well as from the words themselves. And he illustrates this by using this example, God loves a cheerful giver, and makes it clear that we have a lexical understanding of each word, but if we mix the word order up in English and have giver, God loves, cheerful, A, or something like that, we don't get any structural meaning out of that. It's a nonsense statement, even though we can understand the individual meanings of the words. And on the other hand, you can take a nonsense phrase and you can put it in a certain structural order and get some structural meaning out of it and know that it's a sentence and know that, you know, something's a subject and, you know, so forth, have some pretty good ideas as to how to assign where the various words go, but still not have any idea what the word utterance means because you don't have any lexical understanding of the meanings. So this is an important point here, I think a very important point as far as language analysis in general. And it applies equally to Hebrew and to Greek and to English and any other language, I'm sure, that you've got to understand the lexical meanings of the words and the structural meanings of the grammatical devices. And this class, your classes in Greek orientation are designed primarily to give you the ability to ascertain the lexical meanings of Greek and Hebrew words. And a little bit about the structural meanings, you know, they give you a little bit on the paradigms and so forth, but not too much. This class is designed primarily to give you the understanding of the structural meanings involved, the grammatical systems that Greek uses. And then, of course, we'll be dealing with lexical meanings in terms of vocabulary as well. We're not going to ignore those things. But this is the thing you can get in this class that you can't get anyplace else, any other way that I know of, is the understanding of the grammatical devices and how the words are put together in Greek to give meaning. Okay? Then the rest of the chapter is basically, once it gets into section 28 here or so, what he's doing is showing you that the grammatical devices that give structural meaning in English and the grammatical devices that give structural meaning in Greek are different. And in English, one of the most important grammatical devices was word order, whereas in Greek, one of the most important grammatical devices is inflection of various forms, especially nouns here in this particular context, and showing their function by virtue of the endings that they possess. And he talks about in section 29 function words. We'll get into that concept in more detail later on. That's one that's important both in English and in Greek. Function words, things like prepositions and conjunctions and relative pronouns and so forth. They're words that don't have a whole lot of lexical meaning by themselves, but they have a lot of structural meaning. They show relationships between other words.
And then he mentions two grammatical devices that are used in Greek more frequently than in English, and these are the devices of government and concord. Government is the device whereby different inflectional forms are used to indicate the function of a word in the sentence. So there are certain inflectional forms that indicate how that word is functioning in the sentence, and that's government. In other words, there are rules. There's a certain governmental structure that demands that a word, if it's going to be a subject, have a nominative case ending. If it's going to be a direct object, it'll have an accusative case ending. In other words, there are rules that govern where, what form a given noun is going to have in order to function a certain way in a sentence. And then also the government applies to verb forms and other things as well. And so there, by inflections, we mean some sort of a change in the word, in the form of the word. And that change can be of several different types, and he mentions some of these. He mentions actually five different kinds of inflections, and those are indicated in the bottom of page 25 and top of page 26. We have suffixes, which is something stuck onto the end of a word, prefixes, which is something put onto the front of a word, infixes, which is something stuck into the middle of the word someplace, or somewhere in the, you know, not the end of the beginning. Then there's modification, where there's a actual, stem change, where maybe a couple of letters or a letter will change, like sing, sang, sung in English. So you don't have a, there's no prefix or suffix on it, and there's nothing really added to the middle, but there's something changed in the middle. And then there's suppletion, where the form seems to be totally different. Go and went, you see, there's not even one letter in common between go and went, but they're both part of the same verb form. So this is what we call suppletion, where the change is so much that you would never recognize it from the original form. And that will happen once in a while in Greek, too. Not as frequently, but it does happen. Apon and lego are a good example. Okay? So five basic ways of inflecting words. Suffixes, prefixes, infixes, modification, or suppletion. Okay, then there's a device called concord, or agreement, whereby words that are grammatically related have inflections or forms that correspond to each other. And so this is more of a short-term. Concord is more of a short-term thing. It's dictating what phrases go together, what words go together to form phrases, primarily. And it's also involving the verb forms and what noun the verb form goes with. It has the idea of telling you what words go with what words within a sentence structure, whereas government tells you the basic function of the word in the whole sentence structure, as to what function it's carrying out. Concord deals more with how the words within a certain phrase are tied together and how they're interrelated among each other. So words that are grammatically related have forms which correspond to each other. And basically, if verbs agree with their nouns, in the number especially, in Greek also, the articles and the adjectives will agree with their nouns in case, number, and gender. And the details of that are seen in the next chapter. Okay, do we have any questions on this chapter on grammatical analysis? Haven't got a lot of details in here. They're mostly principles that are involved. And you do notice on page 24, the phrase, God loves a cheerful giver, in Greek can be written 24 different ways. Because the word order is not an important device in Greek, at least to determine the function of a word in the sentence. And so they can use a lot of different arrangements there. Okay, well, that's all the time for today. We'll continue this review tomorrow, and tomorrow we'll get into more, slow down a little bit, get a little bit more detail on some of these other facets of things. And be sure and ask questions as they arise. Somebody hand it up to me, or the roll book hiding in the
Okay. Also, I got a note from the administration office on logic, saying that they're a little upset that I haven't been to any classes, and I've been to them.
Oh,
but somehow I've been reported as not having been to them.
Let's see what the rule book says here.
There's one class, which was just last week.
I've seen you. I've talked to you every day in there.
Yeah.
But somehow... you didn't get the rule book. Go ahead and sign in there.
Okay.
I've seen you there, so I know you've been there.
That was the... Now, that week...
That one... Okay.
And that's done by tape.
I know what happened. I passed this rule book and had him sign in for the days before.
Last week?
Yeah. Okay. That's what happened.
I was on jury duty and I had court and stuff like that.
Okay.
What are your initials and actually
made up? Yeah. That one's made up. Got it. Thank you. Okay.
Thanks. Okay, I'll let them know.
Yeah, just tell them that was just a mistake.
Okay.
That I got it squared away in.
I made a comment that it was some sort of fallacy.
Okay, it's a logical fallacy.